Hello and welcome. You're listening to The Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name is Julia Karkatzel, filling in for Peter Frey. Well, debate about press freedom is just as heated as it was a month ago when journalists at the ABC and News Corp were targeted for doing their jobs. Over in the UK, journalists were warned they may face prosecution for publishing leaks following the resignation of Ambassador Sir Kim Darroch. The ambassador's critique of US President Donald Trump triggered debates in media circles as to whether such prosecution is warranted. In other words, was the leak a matter of national security or just plain embarrassing for the British government? Meanwhile, coverage of sexual harassment accusations against Donald Trump from prominent journalist Jean Carroll has stirred controversy, with many feeling there was a lack of coverage by the US media. Which leads us to question the role of the media in what has become the second stage of Me Too. Lots of questions and not as many answers. Well, to answer some, I'm joined by a brilliant panel today. Monica Attard is the head of journalism at the University of Technology Sydney, with 28 years at the ABC behind her and winner of no fewer than 5 Walkley Awards. Welcome.
Hello.
Margot Saville is a freelance journalist for Crikey and has bylines at The Australian, The Sydney Morning Herald and Nine. Margot, welcome.
Hello.
Hello. And Michael Koziol is a political correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, and is a former Fourth Estate host. Welcome,
G'day.
Michael.
It's good to be back.
Yeah. So I'll start with Jean Carroll. Her allegation against the world's most powerful man has been virtually ignored in the news media. The US journalist accused Donald Trump of sexually assaulting her in a dressing room 24 years ago, making her the 22nd woman to claim sexual misconduct by Trump and the second to report actual rape. Jean's story barely made noise in the US media. The New York Times said they underplayed the story, saying a well-known person making a very public allegation against a sitting president should have compelled us to play it bigger. The story didn't make the front pages of notable papers, the Chicago Tribune, the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, and the New York Post even removed the story after orders from a figure close to Trump. Our role as the media is to hold the powerful to account. Are we failing when men of all levels of power can brush off allegations, safe in the knowledge that people don't believe their accusers or simply don't care enough to do anything? Are we failing to do our job as the media?
I think it was a startling failure of media, actually, on this particular story, because the allegation was very detailed. It was pinned to time. It was corroborated in the sense that she had told other people about it contemporaneously. So all of the hallmarks that police investigators might look to if they were charged with investigating it were present. And yet you had media, largely, or all media, mainstream and non-mainstream, basically dismissing it as a kind of, not flippant, but certainly not significant allegation to warrant newspaper space or other media space. I think basically that media really tried desperately to ignore it because they didn't know how to deal with it, and because every time they do attempt to bring down or to slap Trump with fact, with an allegation that looks like it could be based in fact, the president then uses his power and position to tear them down, and so it becomes ever increasingly more perilous for them to operate. So I think it was a terrible failure of media, and I think also it really highlights the challenge of challenging the powerful. And we lost the plot on that one. Well, the American media did, at least. It wasn't our job to pursue it, but certainly the American media, I think, lost the plot.
It's difficult to understand the reasoning behind not running with those allegations, and I've been trying to think about what that justification might be. One of them, I suppose, in a news sense, could perhaps be that, she has put this out there rather than, say, coming to, the New York Times. And I'm sure if the New York Times, she'd gone to the New York Times and said, hey,
instead, she put it in a book.
Put it in a book. So you're already, you're copying something, which, no newspaper wants to do. Nonetheless, I think in this case, it kind of demands that you take notice of it, given the seriousness of what she said. So perhaps that was a factor. And then you've got to also, I suppose we have to face the fact that, you know, part of any part of news journalism and deciding what is newsworthy is a degree of commonality. And we are now in an environment where this is, what was it, the 22nd allegation against this man. You know, at some point, these things objectively do start becoming less newsworthy. Now, I don't think that's the case in this instance, because the allegation is so serious and, as you say, so well corroborated. But at the end of the day, you know, the reality is that, yes, it is going to get less and less likely that these things are reported in a big way, simply because they've become so common and we've become so used to it, and a result of that.
But it's interesting, because I think that's true, Michael, and I think that's true in mainstream media, American mainstream media. I think what I find really curious is the fact that on social media, so if you look at Twitter can still be totally aghast about these things. You know, just yesterday they were in meltdown over the MSNBC footage that was discovered of Trump with Epstein. Eyeing off women and presumably making lewd comments about them. And so, you know, you can still get social media meltdown about it, but it's mainstream media that seems to be shying away and not wanting to tackle it. And I don't, you know, whether it was because the claim was first made in her book, or I don't know why it was. I mean, the New York Times' justification for not pursuing it, I thought, was almost puerile, you know. It was like, oh, you know, okay, we didn't get there.
And of course, the Washington Post made the opposite choice. Was it the Washington Post? I'm pretty sure it was. That put it on page one. It was one of them. There was a major newspaper. I think it was the Washington Post that put it on the front.
Mm. And look, I agree with both of them. And I think, you know, it was a mistake. But there is a sense, I'm sure, in places like the New York Times, that the more terrible accusations you reveal about the president, the more it fires up his base and in a bizarre way increases his popularity. So if you are trying to run a campaign to bring down Donald Trump, having women's, sadly, I think this is a tragedy, accusations of sexual assault don't seem to be working. I don't know what does work. I don't know, perhaps revealing his tax returns to the American public, but you know, that may have been a factor.
I think that's absolutely right, Margot. I mean, I think his base is actually really fired up by his opposition to what he calls political correctness in the sexual space.
Yes.
And so the more lewd he is, the more challenging he is of the kind of niceties that we've come to expect, so to speak, the more they rah-rah for him.
Yes.
That's what's getting him votes. And perhaps also, you know, in the lead up to another presidential campaign, he was laying that down as yet another marker, along with the racism and the dog whistling, for his base. You know, support me, or this is what, you know, you get the other mob who think that this is wrong to, you know.
But that can't be a reason for running or not running something as a media organisation. I mean, it can't be, his base are going to react this way. I mean, that can't enter into the thought process. And you're not suggesting that it did, I don't think, but...
Well, Jean did say that was one of the reasons she didn't come out and with the allegation earlier on, because she thought it would give him more power in the lead up to the elections in 2016, and when obviously she knew about the story her whole life, basically. And so I guess if it is empowering him and we are becoming more desensitized to these stories, how do we tell these stories and kind of get that traction again that we did at the start of Me Too? Is it via social media?
I was fortunate enough to see the Harvey Weinstein documentary at the Sydney Film Festival, and I can recommend it to everyone. And I think, you know, you come out of it feeling like you've been punched in the solar plexus. And, you know, I think that kind of long-form investigative, very, very cautious journalism, you know, it doesn't need to be put on page one every day, although it should be. You know, you can build a case through that kind of reporting.
Sure. Me Too has also seen unintended consequences by going too far with claims from nice men feeling scared of unintentionally being offensive to women, good men being falsely accused or even shamed for minor offences. Has Me Too taken a turn? How do you approach your reporting of Me Too if you do report on it?
Well, it's not something that I've really done in my reporting, but I still think for the most part, the movement has done more good than harm. And I think it was always inevitable that there were going to be some people that were wrongly accused. And we've seen that recently here with the case of John Jarrett. I mean, that's kind of, it's going to be a necessary component to the phenomenon, I think. And, you know, we've got to be careful. You know, that's why you need to do due diligence as a media organisation if you're going to report one of these stories and effectively carry someone's claims into publication. But I don't think it's reached the stage where, you know, we need to say that the Me Too movement is doing all this damage. But I do think it's, you know, a close run thing.
No, I think it's been a really big turning point culturally for the Western world, that we are so aware and in tune with the issue now. I mean, it did have a capacity, I think, at one point, maybe a year ago. I'm kind of struggling to put a time to it, but there was a time where it felt to me as though it had the capacity to become quite dangerous. And that it would backfire, and that the movement would collapse. But it kind of, I don't know how it avoided it, but it did avoid it, and it's turned out to be, and as Michael points out, certainly in Australia, with one or two exceptions, has been a positive thing. So I don't think that it's, you know, I don't think it's dangerous in any way, shape or form. I mean, I actually think it's changed the way we are as people and as the way we operate, what our expectations are as women and what our expectations are of men. And it's laid down some parameters that can't be overstepped, which is fantastic. Mm. What's not to like?
Mm. I think it's a great cultural shift and fantastic. And what, you know, we would have had so many more of these Me Too court cases reported in the media if it wasn't for our punitive defamation laws, which impose an absolute massive barrier to writing about these things. So, you know, there's a whole backload of cases that should be reported that are being looked at by places like the Sydney Morning Herald that just can't get through the lawyers. And I think that's a shame.
Mm. Just, I mean, and just to play devil's advocate slightly on that for a moment, I do think that if there is a danger, it is that the dominant culture becomes one where alleged victims are, you know, there is a demand that they be believed, almost without question, or the default position is that you believe someone who says that they are a victim.
Well, that's actually the law, Michael.
I think. As journalists or whatever, or even as, you know, not just journalists, but citizens, I think the position we should probably be at is that their claims should be taken seriously and deserve to be taken seriously, but they do not necessarily need to be presumed to be true. And I think it's a very fine line, as I say, but I think you it's one that you need to be careful on. The presumption of truth is, you know, is just not always going to be correct, as we've seen with John Jarrett.
I think it's a tragedy when, you know, so many people use it as an excuse, well, I'm not going to have a meeting with a woman alone anymore, or I'm not going to have a work dinner with a woman alone anymore. I think that's just completely ludicrous. People can use their common sense. Just don't be a dick, you know. Think of that.
It's true.
Yeah, but and on that issue, I mean, I think that the law demands that victims' claims be taken seriously, and Victoria has gone so far as to explicitly legislate for that.
Mm. And I think that's completely correct.
And that's completely correct, yeah. I mean, it'll be interesting to see whether other jurisdictions actually follow it eventually. I mean, maybe they will, maybe they will. I think New South Wales has been wavering on the issue for quite some time.
Yes.
But I think there is a little danger in there that the public can become perhaps... they will begin to feel as though the onus always falls on the alleged perpetrator's side, and that the victim is always so believed that that's an immutable, that it becomes an immutable fact. I think that there is a little bit of a danger there.
Mm. And you end up in the same position that journalists often find themselves in defamation cases, where you have to disprove imputations raised by the claimant.
Mm.
Yes.
I think that's exactly right.
Mm. We might move on to Sir Kim Darroch.
The ambassador to the UK resigned last week after his criticism of the Trump administration as inept and uniquely dysfunctional, and that was published by The Mail, a Sunday paper in the UK. Donald Trump, by no surprise, fired back, calling Sir Kim, you know, wacky and deeply unpopular. What do you make of an ambassador having to resign essentially because he told the truth?
Well, it's interesting, I think, because it on one hand, it's a bit frightening because it means that that Trump has the ability to influence the way the UK Foreign Office operates. It's frightening because it means that whoever leaked that communique or that communication between Darroch and the Foreign Office. That kind of leakage would be, you'd be very brave to do it, wouldn't you, really? But on the other hand, it's interesting because Darroch was doing precisely what you would expect a diplomat to do. That's what they're hired to do. They're hired to give frank and fearless advice, be the ears and the eyes of their government on the ground in the country that they're posted to. And this guy was just in the digital age, unfortunately, one of those people whose frank and fearless advice to government has been leaked, and leaked about a really unstable, megalomaniac kind of leader who doesn't like criticism. But I think that the problem is really who the UK government ends up putting in his stead. I mean, what do they do now? Do they put somebody completely from outside the diplomatic service to try and calm Trump down? To what extent are they seen to be caving in to Trump's sensitivities on what Darroch did?
Yeah, and Darroch said that he also resigned because of his future and how, there was kind of no united political front from the UK, no resistance Trump's outbursts.
I was completely fascinated by the class analysis of this. So much came up and said, oh, Sir Kim, he may have been our ambassador, but he's actually a grammar school boy, which, in English parlance is, and Boris Johnson went to Eton. Fascinating. Mm-hmm. And you kind of think, well, if he'd gone to Eton, would they have protected him? I don't know. He seems to be a million times smarter than anybody else in that government. Mm.
Mm. I suppose he was limited in his options because Boris Johnson, I think, kind of made it clear that he didn't want him sticking around, the incoming Prime Minister. But I don't know. I mean, perhaps if that hadn't happened, he could have ridden this out. I mean, Trump himself has rewritten the rule book on this and shown that, well, actually, if you just kind of say, well, so what? You can survive these controversies and they do go away. So I don't know. I mean, obviously felt the need to resign, but I think he could have just taken a leaf out of Trump's book and said, yeah, well, that's what I think, and,
But it's interesting. It's interesting also that you're in a situation now where in the United States, if you want to be there, you've got to support him. You've got to like him. You've got to say yes. You've got to not open your mouth and express your concerns or your grievances because you will get trampled upon.
Yeah, I'll be fascinated to see what our own ambassadors' communiques have been on this.
Yes. Well, I suspect they would have been incredibly cautious. And I think also we're kind of really rapidly moving to the point as well where foreign services will need to consider the way they communicate, that maybe the time for digital communication is gone. Mm. Maybe we're back to, pigeons and...
Dead letter drops.
Dead letter
clandestine meetings in London wine bars.
That's it. Drinking gin.
Exactly.
Yes.
Well, press freedom has also been called into question in the country as the Metropolitan Police launched a criminal investigation into the leak of the messages. The UK's largest police force threatened the media with prosecution for publishing the dispatches. And some have said that a prosecution on this basis would amount to an infringement of press freedom and have a chilling effect on public debate. Parallels here with the AFP in Australia targeting journalists in their investigations into leaks relating to national security matters. This week, the Australian Federal Police Commissioner, Andrew Colvin, was interviewed for the first time since the raids on the ABC, and he dismissed questions of national security, saying, "Democracy relies on a free press, but we also need to do our job, which is to enforce the laws that the Parliament sees fit to pass." So what do you make of this explanation?
I suppose he would say that. And to be fair, that is the task that they're given. So... you know, one's problem really should lie with the ever-expanding suite of alleged national security laws that allow police to do this. And, you know, I mean, to an extent, yes, that it is our job to find out the stuff that the state or whoever doesn't want us to find out, and it would be no fun if, you know, it was all just kind of put out there on a platter. So, yeah, you know, that is their job, is to kind of protect this information of the governments, and it's our job to try and get that by some other means. And, you know, I don't think we necessarily need to be outraged about the police, you know, doing the job that they've always done. We should be very critical of you know, the laws which set the parameters for that. I would also just very quickly say, I think if you kind of read the tenor of some of the commentary, public commentary on this issue, there are a lot of people out there who think that, you know, why should journalists be above the law? And, you know, Peter Dutton's been saying similar things, you know, no one's above the law. A lot of readers out there agree with that. And there's also a degree of commentary that's saying, well, you know, like a lot of people fall victim to invasions of privacy by the state all the time, you know, just normal people out there. And journalists only really seem to be arcing up about it when it comes to them. And I think there's some truth in that. And so I think we collectively need to make sure that we defend everyone's rights against an invasive state.
You're not saying that we're precious.
I think journalists are, without a doubt, some of the most precious people on the planet. And so as right as we might be about this, we should be as vigilant about everyone else's rights as we are about our own.
I couldn't agree more. Actually, I think Will said.
I just think, you know, there's now so much legislation, you know, aimed at preventing us from doing our job. You know, you've got national security legislation, you've got data encryption laws that went through last year, you know, punitive defamation laws, the whistleblowing laws, and you now have this extensive use of suppression orders by the courts, all of which the government has, emboldened the state in a way to stop us from doing our job. And I think it just makes everything harder and harder.
I agree. And Australia has also been in the international eye, with notable human rights lawyer Amal Clooney making comments about Australia at the Defend Media Freedom Conference in London last week. She said the recent ABC newsroom raid was an example of global challenges to freedom of speech. And our Foreign Minister Maurice Payne was also in attendance there at the conference. And Labor Deputy Leader Christina Keneally has attacked her statements about media freedom being a basic human right and a fundamental element of a vibrant democracy, saying that her statement would carry more weight if the government just demonstrated a greater commitment to freedom of the press at home. So how much of this is part of the government's doing?
Well, I mean, she's right, isn't she? I mean... You can't argue with Keneally on that point. I mean, I think the Amal Clooney stuff was interesting. I mean, it was really embarrassing, obviously, and particularly for Maurice Payne sitting there, whichever row she was in, having to listen to it. And coming from Clooney, because she's an international celebrity, puts a spotlight on it. And, oh, my God, she said the word Australia. So that really got us all very, very excited.
We got noticed again.
We always get noticed for the right reasons too, don't we? But I think the question also comes down to a point that Michael made earlier, and that is, does anybody care? I mean, does the public really, really care? Or are they just, you know, they have a tendency to be really, really pissed off when media is seen to be intruding on the privacy of individuals or making claims that are then proven to be incorrect. And so those tend to be amplified and highlighted for them, and it's just another mark against our name. Yeah, I think basically what it comes down to, that whole media freedom thing, which I have to say is critically, critically important, but oh my God, am I sick of talking and hearing about it. I just wish we could get on and be free. I think that the question really does come down to the AFP raise on the ABC were entirely lawful. Were they raids? No, they actually called the day before, in fact, several days before and for many days afterwards, and told them we will be there at, you know, 10:30 on Thursday morning and, you know, please make sure we can get in the building. We are executing legal warrants.
I mean, it is. I have no problem with using the term raid. I mean, they were there to seize material. And I think that whether they, you know,
a raid,
whether
a raid,
they knocked on the door or barged through it, I don't think it really
implies,
matters.
A raid implies, you know, they've got the jackhammers out and they're tearing down doors. Anyway, whatever. It was awful and it was unpleasant and it's unnecessary, but it's perfectly legal. And as Margot said, it's a result of legislative creep that has allowed the work of journalists to be continually more scrutinised and eroded, in a sense. And that's the government has to, you know, grow some balls on this one and do something about it. I doubt it will happen under this current government, and I doubt it would under a Labor government, because Labor is partly responsible for a lot of the legislation as well. Mm. So, I think it's in government's interests to keep the work that it does as secretive as it possibly can, and to impede the work of journalists. And I think journalists are then left looking for love in other places, and I don't think they're getting much from the public.
Mm. And love in other places, there is an inquiry into press freedom that's been established. Do you have any hope for that, or the hope the inquiry will...
God, didn't we have this under Sam Dastyari or something?
Yeah, it is.
You know, this comes up every few years, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Mm. I think you know, his master's tools don't demolish his master's house. I don't think any politician is going to do something that's going to enable us to scrutinise them any further.
Right. Well, on that rather dark note, we'll leave it there. That's all we have time for today. We've been speaking to Monica Attard, Head of Journalism at UTS, Margot Saville, freelance journalist for Crikey, Michael Kazoil, political reporter for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Thanks for listening to The Fourth Estate. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard around the country on the Community Radio Network. Make sure you're subscribed to The Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk media, politics and a few things in between. We'll be back next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is Fourth Estate AU. My name's Julia Karkatzel. Thanks for listening.